Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann. Nonprofit hospitals under the Affordable Care Act must offer charity care in order to maintain their nonprofit status with the IRS. As nonprofits, these organizations are given billions of dollars in tax breaks. These hospitals often have a big imprint as employers and underwriters in the communities they serve. However, when it comes to providing charity care, they're less than charitable, according to analysis done by the Wall Street Journal. Melanie Evans is a health reporter for the Wall Street Journal and was part of a reporting team looking at this issue. Melanie Evans, welcome to All Sides. Melanie, in addition to medical care, how else do these hospitals contribute to their communities in return for not paying taxes?
Hospitals make investments in their communities in a number of different ways. So one of the ways that they do so is that they absorb the losses often for patients who are enrolled in Medicaid. So Medicaid typically pays sort of the lowest amount of any insurance company. And it's sort of hospitals widely lose money on Medicaid patients. So they do get some money from Medicaid, but often it doesn't cover the full cost. So they absorb that. They also, for example, train doctors, future physicians, and the cost of medical education is something that they often report as a benefit to local communities.
So how do hospitals exactly define charity care? We hear the term indigent. Is it sort of the same thing?
So there are a lot of labels for what is essentially a question that hospitals ask, which is, can you afford your medical care? And hospitals answer that, get to answer that sort of like what constitutes affordable. They get to answer that themselves, right? So hospitals, for the most part, get to say, well, we think if you're living at the poverty level, we will give you free care. Other hospitals say, well, if you are living at 2 times the federal poverty level, we will write off your entire bill. They might go a little bit higher and say up to, 400% of the federal poverty level, maybe we'll give you a discount, but you've got to pay something. And so the programs, if you are looking for this information, it might be on the website as charity care. It might be on the website as financial assistance, but it is one of the ways in which hospitals typically give back and report that they give back to communities for these tax breaks.
So in essence, it's confusing to even find out about charity or financial help, those type of things. And we're going to get into that in a little bit. So that's a whole nother part of this. But how much of the hospital's revenue is being written off as charitable care in comparison to actually what they actually give to the consumers?
So this is the question we wanted to ask. We wanted to ask of the resources that they have, that they're taking in, how much of it do they dedicate to this particular benefit, community benefit? And what we found was that in aggregate, when we looked at nonprofits, these are the hospitals that get the tax breaks, 2.3% of their revenue from patients was going to write off the bills of individuals who, met whatever criteria the hospital set. Now, that's for nonprofits. If you look at for-profits, so these are companies that are private equity backed, they're traded on the stock market, they were writing off in aggregate 3.4%. So those for-profit companies actually do pay taxes. And we're doing slightly more. If you looked at government-owned, which could be a district hospital, a county hospital, state, city. In New York here, we have like the New York City hospitals. They did the most at 4.7%.
How do those numbers weigh out? I mean, you got the nonprofits, for-profits, is that equitable? Is it even? Is it one is doing a good job, one's doing not so good job? How does that work out?
So what we did is we talked to academics that sort of look at this question, right? So if we even like maybe take a step back and ask, like, you know, sort of why are we looking at this at all? It's for two reasons primarily. One, the tax breaks, right? They don't pay corporate income tax, they don't pay sales taxes, they don't pay property taxes. And typically when sort of communities look at this, they say, okay, everybody else then shoulders that tax burden. What are we getting in return? So that's like a big community question. But then there's the individual question. If you look at household medical debt, right? Like, so if one of the ways hospitals earn these tax breaks is to alleviate that debt, you know, the burden, the financial burden on hospitals, writing off the medical bills of low-income households is the most direct way to do it. And so there isn't a national requirement. There's no like federal rule that says, okay, you guys got to hit, you know, X percent, or you got to give away so many millions or billions of dollars. It really just falls to each hospital's setting their priorities and then being transparent about it so that locally individuals can look and answer the questions for themselves. Like, are you meeting the obligation in return for the benefit, you know, we as taxpayers have given you?
And so that comes to the question, does it vary from state to state? Because there are some states that are definitely more impoverished than others. And you look at some of the southern states that have a great deal of more poverty. And so that has to really make a difference as well, right?
So what we did is, I mean, one of the things we heard when we were reporting, yes, is, well, you know, I am a hospital that operates in a state that has expanded Medicaid, which means that I've got more people who are insured, which means that I might, you know, that's a group of people who previously they might have qualified for financial aid. So we absolutely looked at that. And what we found is that in Medicaid expansion states, nonprofit hospitals and for-profits were doing about the same. In states where Medicaid did not expand. So these are the states where you would expect more individuals to have a need for the safety net that is financial aid at a hospital. We found that for-profits did more than the nonprofits that earn the tax breaks, that get the tax breaks.
Did you find that to be make sense? I mean, is that in line with what your reporting found?
Yeah, I mean, so what our reporting found was that, what we found there was that where there was potentially greater need, nonprofits did less, though nonprofits get a tax break for giving back.
Wow. So you talked about how Medicare and Medicaid figures into this charitable thing, but doesn't that kind of muddy what, according to what you just said? Because if Medicare is offered more and then some are giving less, so it doesn't seem to make sense. It seems like they're getting a lot of bang for their buck, but they're not really giving to those who need.
Well, so this is the question that, I've covered hospitals for a while. You see Congress ask this question, right? And you see state attorneys general who regulate charities, and you see local communities, and you see advocacy groups really pressing that point, right? Asking the question, are hospitals doing enough to earn the tax breaks that they get? And, you know, we did cite research out of Johns Hopkins that found that tax break, you know, in aggregate is valued at $60 billion a year. And we did talk to individuals who said, you know, like I did this story with two phenomenal colleagues, Anna Matthews and Tom McGinty. Anna spoke with a professor at Georgia State University who made this point, which was that she said, there are many things that hospitals do to give back, but it is not a substitute for not burdening your low-income patients with crushing medical debt. And so you see And in the course of our reporting, we heard individuals sort of challenging the degree to which hospitals give back. And I will say there was quite a bit of variability from one hospital to another. And so, for example, we did cite some big, very prominent hospital systems and some big, you know, systems that are big across an entire state that wrote off like less than 1% of their revenue. And then I spoke with the CEO of a system, a two hospital system in Chicago, Sinai Chicago, and her two hospitals gave away, or, you know, were writing off about, one wrote off roughly 9% of revenue and the other wrote off 16%, right? So you do see that variability. And when you look at the reason why, we did hear from hospitals who said, well, the numbers you're using, they challenged the numbers we were using. So we crunched the numbers a couple of different ways, right? We looked at Medicaid expansion states versus non-expansion states. We looked not just at revenue, but also at expenses, two different ways to kind of compare their spending against the resources that they have. And we did that to sort of like address where there might be some differences from hospital to hospital in revenue. And we found that there wasn't really a big change in the net result, which was that hospitals in the sort of in aggregate in the nonprofit sector did less despite earning these tax breaks.
So when you pressed them, how did they justify not giving the charitable care that they should for the tax breaks they received? How did they explain it?
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, how did they explain it?
So, you know, hospitals said, we do more than write off bills. We give back in a lot of different ways. And if individuals are interested in seeing other ways in which their hospitals give back, they can pull publicly available tax records. You can look it up yourself. You can look your local hospitals up. And they itemize all, you know, the different things that they do. And so I did, for example, list a few at the beginning. You know, they absorb the losses for caring for Medicaid patients. They provide other subsidized medical care. They train future clinicians, doctors, and nurses. And so they put all of that in this, it's called the IRS Form 990, just such a stirring name. But there's a lot in there if you're interested in what your hospital is doing.
So basically, but you talked to the expert who said that what they do extra, the extra things they do, don't equate to making sure folks who need care and can't afford it get it.
So, yeah. So like this is the policy tension, right? So this is the open question. Federal law or federal rules don't dictate what it means for a hospital to give back, right? They say they have to have a written financial assistance policy. They say the policy has to tell people who's eligible and how to apply, but it doesn't, the federal rules don't say like much more than that, right? And so hospitals say, you know, they give back in lots of different ways according to the needs of their communities. And then we talk to others who say the most direct benefit that a hospital can provide is protecting individuals from crushing medical debt they can't afford. And it's not just the financial consequences of that debt, it's also the fear that somebody has that unpaid bills, it may sort of prevent them from going to seek additional care that they need, right? And so that's the policy question at the heart of this story.
So basically, wrapping this up, it seems like there should be more guidelines or some very another look at how this is done to make sure that folks are getting the help they need and that the folks that are getting the tax breaks are actually doing what they need to do to get that tax break?
I mean, this is like, again, I've covered hospitals for a while, and I've seen this debate and these questions sort of surface, right? In the same way that there are questions about how hospitals bill people, right? So once you get a bill, right? How do hospitals try to collect it, right? How aggressive are they? You are exactly right. There are communities across the United States that have and continue to like ask that question. Do we need to like put it in writing?
Bottom line. Melanie, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about charity care and the hospitals. Are they getting too much for the tax breaks they don't give? Stay with us. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann Fisher. We're looking at the issue of charity care this hour and how to help those who need it the most to get it without going bankrupt. The community benefit standard to assess whether nonprofit hospitals benefit community health sufficiently to justify their tax-exempt status. Now, according to our next guest, the standard needs to be revised. G. Bai is a professor of accounting at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. G. Bai, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Natasha, for having me.
Also taking part in our conversation is Jason Coma, Executive Director of Charitable Health Network right here in Columbus. Jason, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
G., let's start with you. Professor Bai, would you tell us the metrics that the Community Benefit Standard uses to assess whether nonprofits benefit from community health?
Thank you. IRS has a mandatory filing for all nonprofit hospitals. It's called Form 990. That's only an information disclosure asking hospitals to report what they did for the community. For example, how much charity care they provided to financially disadvantaged patients, how much unsponsored research or medical education or community health improvement, etc. So hospitals report those spending on the Form 990 report to IRS, but there's no minimum requirement or any guidance like how much they have to provide to justify their tax exempt status.
So what is the current standard that hospitals follow then? If there's no real standard, I mean, do they just kind of just as much as they like, as little as they like? Does it just kind of, it's all over the place?
That's exactly what's happening now. Some states have more stringent, very clear guidance. For example, in Florida and some other states. But in general, at the federal level, there is really no clear-cut guidance on what hospitals need to provide in order to justify their status.
So tell me, Jason, how does the Charitable Health Network help Ohioans obtain the charitable care they need? Because this is obviously a big problem if you're concerned as a person to even seek care because you may not be able to afford it.
Absolutely. So the members of the Charitable Health Care Network really are the backbone of the safety net in the state of Ohio. Our network of, it's a little more than 50 free and charitable clinics across the state are places that individuals can go to receive care free of charge or little or no cost. And really, I think in the broader conversation, fills the gap in what we're talking about. You know, the global discussion today talks about care for the underserved and those who are uninsured. And that's what the Charitable Healthcare Network does. If you look at just last year in calendar 2021, Our members provided more than 100,000 visits across the state, from primary care to specialty visits. And then when you factor in the amount of prescriptions that were given, it's almost, over 400,000. And these are all individuals that would have no other place to go. It is free care. It is charity care. And I think part of the discussion that I'd like to inject today is what our member clinics do as a vital aspect of the healthcare delivery system. Clearly, the conversation and the topic talks about, hospitals that provide acute care. And in fairness, the last guest did mention that it waivers from different community. In Central Ohio, we do have good partnerships with our local hospitals, and they do provide a lot of support. But the discussion itself is, where do people go when they need access to care and have no other means? And free and charitable clinics are that backbone. So happy to expand more on what the gap is. And our members certainly work to fill that.
Talk about the eligibility. I mean, what is the standard that you guys use to be eligible for the charity care?
It's your free clinics.
Just if you need it, we're here.
You need it, we're here. We will have the opportunity to bill Medicaid or private insurance if you have it. But the doors are open. Come see us. We're also working, and I think this is another piece, right? So if you look at the state of Ohio, we've done a great job in Ohio in decreasing the amount of uninsured since Medicaid expansion and really in the last decade to almost cut it in half. I think the latest data that I saw from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio shows us at about 6.5% of uninsured in the state, which is still too high, quite frankly. Those individuals and others can come directly to the clinics. And it's the kind of care that's provided no different than a doctor's office that I go to or you go to. The amount of testimonials and stories of people that, hey, I lost my job, or I'm a contract worker, I had nowhere else to go, and being afraid to seek care, that's what our members do. They provide that care free of charge or to little or no charge. And we're also working to get people enrolled in insurance. So, their work is part of the greater healthcare delivery system. The last part that I would put just in magnitude, right? Our volunteers across the state, I love this number, more than 175,000 volunteer hours provided. So I'm not a math guy, right? I'm not a math guy. So I'm furiously flipping through my notes to make sure I get this right. So more than 175,000 hours of care provided by volunteers. That is 20 calendar years.
Oh, wow.
Just last year, right? And this is the backbone that we're talking about that our members provide all across the state.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, and it's obviously needed because basically there are gaps when it comes to the care that people need and they're able to afford. G, let's go back to you. We talked about metrics and standardizations, but because there is no standardization, what do hospitals need to do to improve their charity care? And how can it be monitored or dictated?
The great question. We believe the first thing to do is more transparency. Many of our resident community members don't realize that how much tax subsidies we are providing to nonprofit hospitals and nonprofit organizations in healthcare. So for example, property tax. If the major player, nonprofit hospitals, or healthcare centers in your community have paid their fair share for property tax, every residence and other business property tax would have reduced. That is true for many communities. So taxpayers are already subsidizing substantially for nonprofit hospitals operation. And beyond the property tax, the hospitals are exempted from sales tax, income tax, also the ability to issue low cost bonds because the bond buyers don't need to pay tax on the interest they earn. And also, wealthy individuals, other organizations are pouring money as charitable donations to nonprofit hospitals. So to sum up, the nonprofit hospitals receiving a lot of taxpayer subsidies. So I believe the first step is to let the public understand how much subsidies they're receiving. So maybe through state level disclosure or federal level disclosure, then people can compare and then make their own judgment whether the nonprofit hospitals are doing a good job.
So what would the administrators like to see in this? I can't think that that's what they want to have to do, more paperwork, more transparency. What are they saying?
I believe they, the first argument would be the high compliance cost. But, the property tax is really not that hard to estimate, right? and the income tax a little bit harder, but I think that information is very important because there's an implicit contract between the community and nonprofit healthcare centers. If you are for profit, that's fine. No, you don't need to worry about, at least in theory, right, to return to the public because you're already paying tax. But the nonprofit hospital really receives so much subsidies. So I believe they have obligation to fulfill and to provide the community, so to justify their status. So that's why I believe we first need to let the data, let the numbers speak. So the public and, you know, the media and the policymakers can understand and then make decisions.
And this is a question I want for both of you. Jason, I'll come to you first. We know that not everyone receives the same level of care. Obviously, in poorer communities, minority communities, they fall behind. What changes would you recommend to improve the overall health care outcomes for those poor or marginalized communities?
How much time you got? So you know, I think there are many different factors that I know that this program has talked about and could talk about further about this. But there's many different things that go into the outcomes. You know, social determinants or social influencers of health. And part of what our clinics help do is provide little things like housing assistance, transportation. All of the other pieces to the puzzle that help go into overall health need to be taken more into account on the overall health, because that's a part of it too. Housing, transportation, childcare, as well as access to, a job that can provide you flexibility as well. All the things that you don't think about as health are also all part of that as well. It's a small portion of the answer. I'm happy to take several more hours, but I know you don't have it.
And we kind of found out, I guess, just the different disparities when COVID happened.
Sure.
You know, that kind of shed a lot of light on some of the deficiencies and things that are in poor communities, marginalized communities. But same question for you, G. You know, how can everyone receive the same level of care? Communities that are poor, minority communities, marginalized communities, rural communities. How can they receive the same level of care? And what recommendations would you have to change these outcomes?
Mm-hmm. Great question, Natasha. So I think we have to recognize there is a trade-off, right? The rural communities, I mean, in theory, if we want to give exactly same level of access to both rural area and the urban area, we'll have to be ready to transfer, you know, a lot of taxpayer subsidy. That's just a reality. So I think the government can do limited things, but the civil societies, like, you know, what Jason's been doing, is super important to fill the gap so that, you know, we can have some beyond the government's ability and transfer the access to the local communities.
Jason, let's talk about hospitals required by law to give charity care, but how can that differ? I mean, how do hospitals inform patients about this charity care? And is that information really out there? Because maybe some people would go and seek care if they actually knew they could get some financial assistance, or if they knew about programs like yours. I mean, is it lack of information? Is that a big determinant in stopping some people from getting the care they need?
There's certain requirements that hospitals have to fulfill in terms of disclosure of their charity care policies, upfront, time of service, etc. I think the communication aspect is a good one that you bring up. You know, we've got a map on our website, charitablehealthcarenetwork.org. Again, charitablehealthcarenetwork.org. It's a giant URL, but please take a look. That shows you all of the charitable and free clinics in our locations across the state. So if you're looking, you can use that as a one-stop shop to find that location. And so access, education, knowledge. I do want to follow up on one last point that was made as well. I think the other thing that's missing in this, you know, in helping bridge the gaps is funding public health. You know, adequately funding public health. You brought up COVID and the disparities that happened in our community. There's an upside down T in Central Ohio where you could look at infant mortality is much higher, and et cetera, along the lines of almost every other health metric, and COVID metrics were worse there. We should have known, and we could have known that was the case. So I think, you know, our public health, both Columbus Public Health and Franklin County Public Health, are phenomenal people who do a great job, woefully underfunded. You know, our network itself receives funding from the Ohio Department of Health. Very happy to receive the uninsured care fund, thanks to the General Assembly. But it's a small amount compared to the total need that is out there. You know, in our case, you know, of all the visits that I said we provided, you know, over 100,000 and 400 plus thousand counting prescriptions, we received 1.5 million a year from the Department of Health, money that we're very, very supportive of and very happy we received. All totaled, the cost of what we provide is $183 million of healthcare services. So you take all of those services that you know, numbers are tough. I'm rattling off a lot. You take all of the care that's provided at all of our clinics, and if it were to take place somewhere else, that would cost the system $183 million. We are thankful that we receive funding from the Department of Health to offset that, but that's just a portion of better funding public health, both to help support our clinics, but also to look at some of the disparities that were just mentioned.
And those disparities aren't just here in Central Ohio, because I was living in another state when COVID broke out, and the disparities were just as great in that state. But these are things that it appears that the lawmakers need to work out, that everyone needs to work out to make sure that we have some equitable care. How should people apply for charity care? You know, that's another thing, the whole education thing.
You know, so a couple answers to that question. First, within the broader topic, have the upfront conversation when you're seeking care. There is no reason to, I will say at all of the clinics and members within the charitable healthcare network, we remove that stigma or perceived stigma. It's like walking into a doctor's office in a location like you would in any other place. But when you are in those other settings, to be able to have the upfront conversation that they should be having with you. And also at the end of the day, we want to make sure people get the care that they need when they need it, so that those health outcomes don't get worse. And, you know, it impacts all of us when that happens. So the best way to do that is to have the upfront conversation. Or, as I said, if you find yourselves in a situation where you would need access to care, at charitablehealthcarenetwork.org, there's a full list of our clinics as well.
Well, thank you very much, Jason. I know you're going to be staying with us for our next segment. Gee, thank you so much for being with us and talking about a very important topic. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann Fisher, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann Fisher. We're looking at the issue of hospitals and charity care this hour. As part of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, U.S. hospitals are required to waive or substantially reduce bills for patients with low incomes as a condition of maintaining their nonprofit status. According to a 2020 Gallup poll, half of Americans fear a major health crisis would bankrupt them. In 2012, Jared Walker founded a nonprofit, Dollar Four, to help people in medical crisis. Jared, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still with us is Jason Coma, Executive Director of the Charitable Health Network. And Jared, you created something to really dig down into this. You created Dollar Four to help families in medical crisis. Would you define what a medical crisis means in relation to your particular organization?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you get a medical crisis and then there's a financial crisis. So I would define a medical crisis as any time where you're trying to figure out how to pay the bill afterwards. That's kind of where we come in and try to help relieve that.
And you decided to basically open or start this organization because of your own your own medical crisis that you had and this concerns you had, right?
Yeah, my wife and I were sitting at home and she got a phone call. Her aunt had passed away from cancer. And then a couple minutes later, I got a phone call and my cousin had gone into labor 7 weeks premature. Baby needed a heart surgery to live. And people were wondering, how are we going to pay for it? And that was kind of the first time that I'd seen, you know, that play out, medical crisis, and then all of a sudden financial crisis. And I wanted to help relieve that burden for people.
And Jason, that's what you see on a regular basis, because basically people come to you because they just have nowhere else to turn. They can't afford to pay. In some cases, they can't afford to pay anything.
Absolutely. And including, take that scenario even one step further. Sometimes with those high insurance bills becomes, as you've talked about, a financial crisis, potentially bankruptcy, potentially a loss of employment for a lot of different reasons. And then you still need the care. And so part of our members, what we do is to be there both in the upfront to screen in case there is that cancer or other diagnosis that requires a higher level care and catching it early. So having that primary care up front, but also being the underlying safety net that fills the gap of our care delivery system. You know, when people think about where to go when you're in need, that's what we do. That's where we're responsible for our patients and improving health across the state. We've got a slogan. I love this. As you walk into our office, stronger, healthier, together. And we need to think about that from a global standpoint, not just the story that was just told, and what it sounds like a really cool endeavor, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of it. But that story is so common, right? That happens very frequently, and all of us are one phone call away from that same situation, and our members are there to be able to help.
So, Jared, let's talk about hospital paperwork being overwhelming. We all know that. You go into a doctor's office, you have to fill out paper after paper after paper, jump through many hoops. Would you take us through the process on what someone would have to go through to get help from $4?
Yeah, well, to get help from $4, you just got to go to $4.org/help. We've got a little eligibility screener. We had about 50 volunteers last year. Capture the financial assistance policy data for every hospital in the country, put it into a web tool. So now a patient can put in their household size, income, what hospital holds the debt, and it will tell them what they're eligible for according to their hospital's policy. So that's what you would need to do with $4. Once we find out if you're eligible, you'd be connected to a patient advocate, and we can walk you through the steps, fill out the paperwork, send it in. And then there's also like a self-advocacy track if people just want to take the info and run. We're happy to empower them to do that. So that's how you would get help from $4.
So $4 is based in Portland, Oregon, but you answered my next question. So basically anyone from any part of the United States can get help.
Yes. Yep. We're based in the Pacific Northwest, but we have crushed medical bills from every state.
Oh, that's good news. So are there similar organizations, you know, to $4 throughout the country? I mean, I know that you have your health network, but I mean, are there other organizations that are more grassroots? It seems like you kind of just found the problem and tried to find a solution.
To the best of my knowledge, I don't know of another organization that is enforcing hospitals' charity care policies. I do know that there are some, you know, great organizations that are in the medical debt space, but tackling different issues. So yeah, financial assistance is just one of those things that nobody really knows about. It's not really known. It's not really accessible. And there's no real accountability for it. So we're trying to step in and be that.
And Jason, obviously, you're right here locally doing the same thing.
Right. And I think, you know, part of the conversation that we're talking about that you just heard there as well, let's even take a step back. When someone goes to a doctor or gets that phone call, it's not their best day. Right. It, as simple as or as upfront as perhaps some of that paperwork could be, perhaps some of the conversations could be, you're also not in your right mindset. So having support from case management or patient advocates, as Jared mentioned, is vitally important. Also, that's fulfilled within our organization where you come see us. We can also provide case management for you. We can also help you out along that journey. Absolutely. I think that no one ever wakes up in the morning. I know I don't, and no one I've ever met wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? Today's a great day to see the doctor. Nobody does that. And so the last thing that you should be worried about when you do that is what the bill's going to be, whether you walk in the door and how much comes out of your pocket or how much you get billed after the fact. Our members try to take that peace of mind from folks that both live day to day and have broader concerns. And we wouldn't be able to do that, like I said, without the support that we receive, not only from the state, but also funders and generous other donations, too.
And you talked about the number of volunteers that you guys have that help you make this possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I will go back because it is a mind-boggling stat. Mm-hmm. 175,000 volunteer hours provided at all of the members of the Charitable Healthcare Network in 2021. That is 20 calendar years. I'm going to keep doing that because it is just there are very few paid positions within any of these clinics, only about a little more than 300 across the state. And the rest is volunteers. These are physicians, many of whom work at your local hospital, including several within Columbus in the members of the network here who give their time to be able to provide care to those when they need it most.
Jared, let's talk about before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, how many people actually were filing bankruptcy because of their medical costs? I know you guys have done some research on that.
At the time it was, I think, 65% of bankruptcies in America because of medical debt when I started the organization.
And so was that mind-boggling to you? Because you basically started it because you saw a crisis in your family, taking place. I mean, did that kind of blow your mind?
It did. It was something. I think I was 23, 24 when that happened. So it was the first time that I had, seen that. And then I'm reading the stats. And at the time, I remember reading, 65% of bankruptcies in America because of medical debt. 78% of these people have insurance. So it's not, an insurance, not insurance issue. And then the one that really got me was 85% of the people that are declaring bankruptcy because of medical debt, it's on bills that are less than $10,000. And that one really struck me because, I'm thinking, oh, bankruptcy, it's probably $100,000 bill or something. It's just not the case. When you get a surprise, $5,000 bill, if you don't have it, it may as well be $100,000. So that was really shocking, but it also motivated me to think, we can make a dent in this. We can help people.
How much have you had to expand what you do, though, as a result of, say, the pandemic, with everything that's going on? Because people now have long haulers and, they've gotten over the pandemic or they've gotten over the COVID to a point, but they still have these conditions and these ailments and they still need to see doctors and they need therapy. I mean, have you had to expand the services in Dollar Four to help people with situations because of COVID?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of last year, Dollar Four was myself and we were in the Pacific Northwest. And now we are throughout the entire country. We have hundreds of volunteers and multiple staff that are doing this. So it is, there's no lack of need. We kind of had a viral moment on social media last year that brought us to the forefront, and we've been trying to, catch up ever since. So it's definitely expanded what we've had to do.
You say there was a social media explosion of sorts. What was it that triggered that social media viral moment?
I have posted a TikTok video that basically just explained what charity care and financial assistance was, how to access it. And my big mistake was telling people that if they needed help, they could DM me. So I didn't have any followers or anything at the time. So I posted just thinking, maybe 50 people will see this. Turns out closer to like 30 million people saw it. So,
wow.
So it was, we were overwhelmed for quite a bit. We had to expand everything that we were doing. So, here we are.
This is a different day. And back when I was in school, I'm not going to reveal my age, but we didn't have, I'm saying high school, we didn't have social media.
I grew up without the internet. You're all right. You're internet. In good company.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So how has it changed the way you do things? I mean, you can put things out immediately. You can get more people to talk about it immediately. You can push the message out there. So that has to be a positive along with some of the negative that comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've had to adapt, all of us within the healthcare delivery space, but specifically to CHN, in trying to find a way to reach those patients differently. I referenced earlier at our website, you can go and find a map of a clinic. We've tried to accelerate ourselves so that when you Google, we're higher up in the Google search as well. Still working a little bit. I might have to grab Jared's number offline because, you know, on the social media aspect, still working a little bit to do that outreach. But if you look especially at the younger generation, far younger perhaps than both of us, I'm not going to, you know, right? that's where most individuals both get their news, both get their information. And we all need to be smarter because the challenges aren't any different, right? You know, the need will remain moving forward based on how our healthcare delivery system is set up. And one of the goals that we have at the Charitable Healthcare Network is to provide a vital resource to fill that gap. We got to think a little bit different, more differently into the future on how to reach people. But again, Jared, if you can give me a few TikTok pointers, I'm ready.
So also, can you talk to me about like how you've had to change, you know, not just because of social media, just because of need? How have you had to expand what you do? I mean, you know, COVID changed a lot of things for everyone. I mean, did you have like a swell of people that came to you with, you know, needs and things they had to have and couldn't afford because of COVID?
Yeah, part of the challenge, I think, within healthcare in general was really redesigning the way care was provided. You know, that means adding more telehealth visits. That means, you know, connecting with people to do so a little bit differently, which members of the network certainly did. And they did provide a number of telehealth visits, which thankfully are able to do in the state of Ohio and federally based on changes in waivers and regulations as well. But also redesigning the delivery within the office setting, you know, making sure the space is maintained and et cetera. And one of the challenges that exist across the entire healthcare delivery system is really about the last year and some change, letting folks know it's okay to come back, right? Don't perhaps you put off that primary care appointment because of concerns. You know, originally when the pandemic started within healthcare, we said, hey, only come if you're really, 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 really sick. You know, that's been almost 2 years now, right? Mm-hmm. So it's okay to come back, check in with your primary care provider. If you don't have one, work to find one. If you're not sure where to go, turn to the Charitable Healthcare Network, get that screening done, get the wellness checks done so that we can prevent something that moves forward. But that was just a massive sea change in really the way everything has been delivered. And hopefully the telehealth aspect is here to stay moving forward. I know it's changed the way I seek out care personally and as well as our members too.
And just quickly for me, we only have like a minute or so. How can they get help if they need help with their medical bills through your organization?
Absolutely. So we're the Charitable Healthcare Network. All one word, charitablehealthcarenetwork.org. Go to that website. You can see Find a Clinic, and we have 50-plus members all across the state, and you can get the number and access to that clinic as well. If you can't find it, our number and our email is on there at charitablehealthcarenetwork.org.
Okay. And Jared, I have that same question for you. If they need you to come to Dollar 4 to get some information to try to figure out what they need to do next, how can you help them with that?
Yep, $4.org/help goes right to our screener. You can just go to our website. Millions and millions of people are on payment plans. They're declaring bankruptcy for bills they don't have to pay. These hospitals have financial assistance and charity care policies. It's just most people don't know about them. So we try to enforce those. And I think we just hit $20 million in medical debt relief. So it works.
So how much pushback have you gotten from hospitals and organizations? Let's hear about that. You can give me that in about 35, 40 seconds.
Yeah, you know, we haven't gotten a lot of pushback. I think that, you know, there's a federal law that says that these hospitals have to do this. So when we talk to hospitals, they're always very positive. We love that you do that. It's great. More people should know about it. But it doesn't go really farther beyond that. A lot of hospitals are... make this extremely difficult for patients to find and access. And sometimes they just throw in their own rules into their policies that aren't even legal. So we try and fight that. So
part of that, though, is because of the lack of regulation in, you know, the amount of charitable care, right?
Yeah, I mean, the ACA and 501R describe charity care, but it's pretty loose. It's like, hey, you have to have a policy. What that policy has in it, hospitals can...
Kind of do it their own way. Well, yeah, Jared, thank you so much. We're running out of time. Thank you so much. $4 is your organization. People can contact you, I'm sure, online. Jason Coma, thank you very much for coming in. Executive Director of the Charitable Health Network right here in Columbus. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.